I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to CBC Radio's Quirks and Quarks. This is where you pose the puzzlers and we probe for the experts. This week, Barry Milavsky in Toronto writes, "We hear a lot about new animal species being discovered, and last week on your program, there was an old one rediscovered in Laos. We also hear about prehistoric human fossils being different species. Is there a quantitative way that scientists differentiate species? For instance, when looking at a Great Dane and a Chihuahua, how would you know that they're the same species?" For the answer, we turn to Dr. Robert Rice, professor of biology at University of Toronto at Mississauga. So, Dr. Rice, how do scientists define a species?
For living species, we use the biological species concept, and that means that you are looking at animals and see whether they naturally interbreed and eventually produce viable offspring.
Okay, that's for living animals. How do you do that when you're looking at fossils?
Well, this is absolutely the $64 question, I suppose, because in practice, we can't do that with fossils. Most of the time, people working on living taxa don't do that either. They basically use what I would call a morphological species concept. In other words, we're looking at their morphology, their structure, and we're looking for unique characters that would define one species relative to another, would allow us to differentiate them. The problem with that is that we may not be looking at equivalents of living biological species. We may be looking effectively at larger categories, because we know already that in living species, you cannot tell apart valid species simply on the basis of the skeleton.
Can you give me an example?
One beautiful example appeared in today's Nature, where they described a new carnivorous dinosaur from Solenhofen. And it's a baby. It's a very small individual. It's the only specimen we know of this. Is it really valid to call it the new species? We don't know what the adult would look like. Maybe it would look like something that we already know.
Well, what if we take Barry's example here, go into the future, and somebody was to find the bones of a Great Dane and a Chihuahua? How would they know that those two very different skeletons are actually the same species?
Well, in that case, actually, we are not looking at natural populations. We have actually messed these poor animals up. We have played with their genes by doing artificial selection. So it's probably, if we look at from your perspective, probably they're going to be defined as different species because they would not naturally interbreed. They're just too different in size. And one could even argue, are they really the same species anymore? Hmm. We call them dog, but can they actually interbreed?
I see. So, but is it possible then that in the fossils, things that we're calling different species may actually be the same species? Could we be making mistakes on how we define things?
Oh, absolutely. And this is the fun part in paleontology. Generally, we have a tendency to clump ourselves into two groups, those that actually tend to name too many species, and we call them splitters, and those who tend to synonymize many species that have been described in the past, and we call them clumpers. I tend to be more of a clumper.
Well, how much of an issue is that in paleontology, where you have to argue about whether or not you have new species?
Well, it is a very important issue, simply because it's not only is it a scientific issue, but it's also a social issue. In other words, if we want to become famous, then we name new species.
If you name a new species, you get your name on it. Is that the
idea? That's right. If you actually can recognize that two specimens are the same species, then the questions are going to be different than if those two specimens are actually different species. So it continues to be an interesting problem and an interesting issue in vertebrate paleontology.
Dr. Rice, thank you very much.
No problem.
Dr. Robert Rice is a professor of biology at the University of Toronto at Mississauga. Now we take all your questions, so send them in. If your question is used on the show, you get a Quirks and Quarks 30th anniversary t-shirt. We'll give you the addresses in just a minute. Last week on the program, we presented a documentary on the perils of preemies. It looked at the medical and ethical questions surrounding the birth of extremely premature babies, some born only 23 weeks into a pregnancy and weighing less than a kilogram. And that poses agonizing decisions for doctors and parents over when to use heroic life-saving measures on an extremely premature baby. Well, that documentary brought a wide range of feedback from you. Carol Stinson sent us this email. I am appalled that you felt this was an appropriate program to broadcast. Why not ask the question, why are we keeping 90-year-olds alive? After all, they have no potential for a future life where they will be contributors to society. This program was one-sided and not the least objective. Where were the voices of adults who live with cerebral palsy, or youth who live with cerebral palsy? Ask them if they should have been put out of their misery at birth. Brenda Rome sent these thoughts. I did not think that your program put enough emphasis on the idea that often the mother delivers prematurely because there's a defect in the fetus and it's nature's way to cull deformities and genetic weaknesses. I don't mean this to sound harsh, but are we weakening the human gene pool by interfering with the course of nature, which often causes spontaneous abortions or miscarriages or premature births? Those are nature's way to deal with imperfections that would otherwise cause a baby to die in infancy, but for the intervention of fancy modern medicine. Zanna Joyce had these comments. With the increase in acceptance of the idea of euthanasia, it seems likely that people who could live perfectly reasonable lives, with simple accessibility supports, may now be at risk at birth. This is the second story I've heard on CBC this week where a parent has admitted that she would not have chosen to give birth to a child with significant disabilities. It really indicates to me the magnitude of the crossroads we are at as a society. And finally, Khalid Aziz, an associate professor of pediatrics at Memorial University of Newfoundland, sent this email. I take issue with the implication that we can reliably predict which very small babies can do well at the time of delivery, and therefore not resuscitate them based on stage of pregnancy alone. Making decisions after seeing who responds well to resuscitation would greatly reduce the chance that we would allow someone to die who would otherwise have survived and been healthy. If there is a fair chance of survival, we should always offer parents the option for resuscitation of their baby, followed by evaluation. And that's it for this week's edition of Quirks and Quarks. Next week, the Weathermakers, what climate change means for the fate of the Earth. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can write to Quirks and Quarks, P.O. Box 500, Station A, Toronto, Ontario, M5W1E6. Our email is quirks@cbc.ca. And the number to call if you want information on purchasing CD copies of the program is 416-205-2495. And to get to our webpage, just go to cbc.ca/quirks. Quirks and Quarks was produced by Jim Hanman, Jim Lebbins, Pat Sensen, and Robin Smythe, with technical help from Tim Lorimer. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.